Hello, I'm Rosie Perez, and you're listening to Food Fridays with Leonard Lopate on WNYC and WNYC.org.
Nearly everyone who likes to cook has developed some piece of kitchen wisdom, whether it's the fastest way to tell if eggs are fresh or a way that you've discovered to grate soft cheeses. Well, all this month, we have been asking you to submit your kitchen tips and cooking insights on our show page at WNYC.org. And joining us now to talk about them and to give us some of his own is Chris Kimball, the editor and founder of Cooks Illustrated and Cooks Country Magazines, host of America's Test Kitchens on PBS. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, if you have a clever cooking tip that you'd like to share, you can give us a call at 212-433-9692. You can also post it on our show page, WNYC.org, or on our Facebook page. And if it's an especially short tip, you can tweet us. Our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Well, Chris, aren't some of the best cooking and recipe ideas discovered by accident?
Yeah, and some of the dumbest ones, too, because there's hand-me-down information, which sometimes made sense 100 years ago but doesn't now. But you're right. In Cooks Illustrated, we have a two-page section in the front called Quick Tips, and they're almost entirely generated now for 20 years by readers. And they come up with stuff that out of necessity, that we would never have thought of. And so that's some of our favorite stuff in the magazine.
And what are some of your favorites that you've come across over the years?
There's some of the ones I love are kind of silly, like, you know, using a hair dryer to get a glossy sheen on your chocolate frosting on your cake. I mean, anything with a hair dryer in the kitchen has got to be good. Using miniature marshmallows on the top of toothpicks, so when you cover a cake with plastic wrap, it doesn't hit the frosting. I mean, there's some of those. But we have a lot of people, for example, if you have a chef's knife and you want to carry it somewhere, use the cardboard inner tube from a paper towel and flatten it out a little bit, and it makes a perfect scabbard for a chef's knife. It also is a good thing to put tongs in sometimes for storage. So there's, you know, there's storage, there's fancy cake decorating, and there's all sorts of stuff, and I've learned a lot of stuff from that.
And one of the ones I remember is from the February issue, where a reader suggested using flour to wash your hands after you've kneaded sticky dough. He said, coat your hands with flour, rinse under cold water, because hot water causes the dough to gelatinize, thus requiring more scrubbing. Sometimes it seems the best shortcuts come from a basic understanding of chemistry.
Well, cold water, anytime you do have a dough, especially yeast dough, I always rinse with cold water or clean it. You're right, because it'll come off faster. And once you add hot water, it becomes stickier. So with or without the flour, cold water is always the way to clean those up. But, yeah, you know, my favorite things, though, are like this, the classic case of the grandmother handing down to the mother, to the daughter, the recipe for a roast, which you cut into two pieces and roast separately. And that was because she didn't have a big enough pan, you know, to hold the whole roast. So a lot of things in cooking are conventional wisdom, which are not true, like searing meat, seals, and juices is just not true. But sometimes people come up with ideas that are fabulous that ends up, you know, being things we actually use in our test kitchen.
Well, we've had a number of listeners respond to our call. Some of them have shared their philosophical thoughts to the kitchen. PJ in New Jersey left a comment on a show page saying, "Cooking is not like riding a bike. In order to be a good cook, you must actually cook on a regular basis. Otherwise, your timing, as well as all your other senses, sight, smell, hearing, taste, become a little rusty." Do you agree with that?
Yeah, meaning that if you haven't been on a bike in 10 years, you can pick it up in 2 seconds?
Yeah,
I do, and I think the issue for me for cooking is it is a pleasure, and it's not something you want to do in the shortest amount of time. I mean, there are practical considerations, getting food on the table, I understand that. But if you get to the point that you really enjoy the cooking process, which is what we believe, then the time invested is not time invested, it's fun. And the more you do it, the better off you get. And that's exactly right. You smell when the cake is done. You can look and see if something needs to be turned. You can hear something. Very often when I'm in a kitchen, I use hearing sounds to indicate to me that the heat's too high, the heat's too low, something's not sautéing at the right speed. And you lose that if you don't do it all the time, sure.
Another listener suggests when cooking with wine, make sure you save a glass for yourself. I've heard that a lot, but can't being a bit tipsy be a problem when you're cooking?
Not for me. That's an excellent reason to cook. First of all, if you're cooking with wine, you need to use the same quality wine that you'd actually enjoy. So the idea of saving a glass implies you're using high-quality wine. I mean, cooking wine's garbage, and a low-quality wine's just not going to taste good. The other trick with wine is, especially red wine, is I simmer it separately, very slowly, and really concentrate it. You can then freeze it like in ice cube trays, or just use it right away. But you get a concentrated reduction, and that way you get really good flavor. If you just throw wine into a stew and then reduce it, it's not nearly as good. So a nice slow reduction, sort of at a sub-simmer, is a great way to get concentrated wine flavor. And sort of a medium-bodied red like a Cote de Rhone is usually the best choice.
We are getting a lot of calls from listeners, so I want to put a few of them on. Donna from Long Island, hi, you're on the air.
I love your show. I'm sitting in my new kitchen in my new house eating lunch with you guys. My tip is I freeze ginger so that when I grate it into my stir fry, it goes in easier. And if I can take one more minute, if you could give me a tip off the air, I have a new electric stove. And if you have any words of wisdom of how to use them, I would love it.
Sure. The ginger is a good tip. You can use a microplane grater for ginger, which actually works pretty well as well. I do have a tip about the electric stovetop. I'm not a big fan of electric because I like to see the gas and it reacts faster. We find in general if you heat a pan on low on an electric stovetop for a few minutes, then you get a nice even heat at the bottom of the pan, and then you can go turn it up. So especially on electrics, I would start with like 5 or 6 minutes, get a skillet, always put a little oil into it because when it starts to smoke, it's ready. But heat it on low or medium low, just get a nice even heat.
Oh, great help. I'm a gas person that's got to use electric. Love it. Thank you so much.
Thank you for calling,
Donna. There's one other thing, too. If you want to reduce the heat in a pan or a saucepan, instead of leaving it on the burner and reducing the number, take it off the burner, and as soon as you take it off the burner, the heat goes down. Then turn the burner down and wait a minute and put it back on, because that'll reduce the heat much faster.
Excellent. Thanks.
Now, Donna talked about freezing things. A number of people have suggested freezing stuff. Carolyn left this comment on our show page. When you've an hour to spare, buy the big bag of russet potatoes, cut them into thirds, boil them gently until tender, squeeze them through a potato masher, and then freeze them, they say. She says, and then you can microwave them for mashed potatoes. What do you think of that idea?
I don't know about that. I mean, the problem with freezing is things that have high water content tend to be problematic in freezing. Certainly fat, if you added a fair amount of fat to it, that would probably help. But even if you put it through a ricer, which is what she's suggesting, you're still going to have a fair amount of water in potatoes. So I mean, if there's enough fat and cream and butter in it, that might work. But they're high water content vegetables.
But then there are other things that do freeze well. Peas, bread freezes well.
Yes. Bread does very well, yeah.
And there's a big debate over whether you should freeze coffee beans.
We've actually tested that here, and we found that if you're going to hold coffee for 2 or 3 days, the refrigerator's fine. But after about 3 days, you're much better off. These are whole beans. You're much better off in the freezer. But, you know, we could do 5 shows consecutively on the problems with making a good cup of coffee at home. But freezing beans is the way to go long term, definitely.
Now, Caroline, who did the mashed potatoes, also posted a quick recipe for garlic oil. She says, mince an entire head of garlic and microwave in 1 cup of olive oil at half power until lightly brown. This potion keeps for a month or more in the fridge. Use oil or garlic bits or both, depending on the dish. Obviously, she likes using the microwave. This is the second thing she said with the microwave. I've spoken to many serious cooks who say they don't even allow one in their kitchen. What are your thoughts on microwaves?
I don't have one because and it only does a couple of things I like. It heats maple syrup, but I can do that on the stove. It does melt chocolate very well, but I can do that on a double boiler. I'm a big double boiler fan. I have an old-fashioned one. We use one, actually, to be fair, here in the test kitchen. We do have microwaves. And we've used them more and more as a sort of early step, like you par-cook something, like eggplant or potatoes or other things, and then you finish them up in an oven or a skillet, and it can vastly reduce cooking time. It does one other thing. It also can reduce the water content of some certain things, which makes them brown better. So we've used them more and more, but as a first step, it's not the entire cooking. It's just the first step. So it does have a place in the kitchen.
Well, Barbara Kafka wrote a cookbook years ago in which she said that it's really good for dishes that you steam, like some fish.
Yeah, the Microwave Gourmet book. I remember that about 20 years ago. I cooked out of that fairly extensively. I thought it was one of by far the best books on the topic. I think for me, though, you can steam. You know, I can steam on top of the stove. And the other thing is, the problem with the microwave is you have to open the door and you take it out and then you take the wrap off and then there's the steam. You have to check it. If you have something on top of the stove, you can just take the top off and look at it if you're steaming. So it's much easier to control and check the cooking process. And that's one of the things I don't like about the microwave. If you're going to finish something in a microwave, knowing when it's done can be painful because it's easier to just check it on top of the stove. But she's right. It does steam fairly well, but so does a simple steamer.
Astor from Long Island, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for having me. My tip is for peeling garlic, I use a lot of garlic, and the easiest way to peel it is if you soak it for a few minutes in cold water, it peels very easily. That's it.
So you put it in cold water,
and in a bowl, and I just put it in cold water, soak it for a few minutes, 5-10 minutes, and it's very easy to peel.
Isn't it just as easy to peel, Chris, if you take the flat of a knife and bang it on, cut off both edges, ends, and then just smash it, and the peel comes right off?
Yeah, that works well. I mean, I'd like to try the cold water idea. It sounds interesting. The other thing I would say is that I do not like dishes. We have that strong garlic taste, and I don't know why, because in Italy, I've never had anything that had a residual garlic taste, although they use a lot of garlic. So it may just be the growing conditions. But here, a lot of people now, a lot of recipes I see, we do it too, is just you smash a couple cloves of garlic and use the whole clove when you're cooking beans or whatever you're doing. And then you just take them out before you serve them. And that gives you a nice, subtle garlic flavor instead of mincing it or chopping it and leaving it in. So a smashed garlic clove is a great flavoring. In a salad dressing, for example, you let the salad dressing sit 10 or 15 minutes with the cloves in it, but you don't actually serve the cloves, which I like a lot.
Do you have any hints for mincing things like garlic or onions?
Yes, it's called a garlic press. You know, Jacques Pepin would probably shoot me.
He does not like the garlic press.
I know he doesn't. We fought about it, but I think he's wrong. He's wrong only because he's so good. He's like a master with a knife. He's brilliant. Most people aren't, including me. And so a garlic press for 2 or 3 cloves is by far the best way to do it. It's not worth trying to get someone to mince garlic because most people don't have the knife skills that Chuck does.
What about onions? Because you not only do you have a problem sometimes mincing it, but of course there are the tears.
Well, first of all, a lot of recipes call for minced garlic when you don't need minced garlic. I mean, this is not pavillon or côte basque or grand huit. You know, you don't have to have perfectly minced garlic for most dishes. So I don't worry about it too much, especially if they're being cooked. The second thing is you want a really thin knife. And I find a lot of chef's knives these days, the high-carbon stainless, they're very thick. That is the thickness of the blade. And that makes it kind of hard to work with onions or other things delicate. So I bought a Sabatier old-fashioned carbon steel knife. Those are the ones that rust, you know, but they're very thin. And some of the Japanese knives, the vegetable knives, are very thin. And that makes mincing onions much better. As far as the fumes go, we've tried everything. The candle method, you know, you light a candle next to the board. Freeze them. The only thing that really works is, you know, ski goggles. Mm-hmm. I mean, swim goggles. But you know, life's too short to wear swim goggles when I'm mincing onions. I just do it fast. So.
My guest is Chris Kimball, the editor and founder of Cooks Illustrated and Cooks Country magazines, a host of America's Test Kitchen on PBS, and he's in a lot of other things as well. And we're very pleased that he has agreed to join us today to talk about some of the tips that he has and that our listeners have for making cooking a little easier. We'll take a little break and Come back with more. We're back with Chris Kimball of America's Test Kitchens and Cooks Illustrated and Cook's Country magazines. And we are inviting your calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. What's usually the easiest way to correct a dish that is tasting a little funny as it's cooking? Do you add more salt, more sugar, or acids like vinegar or lemon juice?
Great question, and that's the biggest problem people have at home. They don't actually taste the food before they serve it. They just follow the recipe. So,
and when should they start tasting it?
You should taste it all the way through the process, but if you don't, the one thing you got to do before you serve it, of course, if it's a cake, you're done. But if it's a soup or a stew, et cetera, you do it right at the end before you serve it, and you want to take a couple of minutes and take your time. And so here are a bunch of things you can do. Obviously, salt level. Most people are scared to death of salt. Only 5% of your salt intake is from home cooking, so don't worry about it. And most people undersalt. Sweetness, especially so much of the Mediterranean cooking, you know, they balance the sweetness and sour and salt. Little things you can add are honey. You can add, I like pomegranate molasses, which I made fun of for years, but I have a little bottle of it. You can add a little bit of that at the end. Certainly ginger. Maybe a little bit of garlic are things you can add. A lot of fresh herbs, the more delicate herbs, are better added at the end of cooking than the beginning. So you can add a little bit of thyme or dill or parsley or whatever, scallion even at the end. And vinegar, as you said, is something you can definitely add at the end to give it a little bite. But fiddling with those tastes at the end, a couple minutes, makes the difference between a mediocre dish and a really good one.
We have a number of people who have written in. Keith on Twitter shared this tip. Wipe a measuring cup with mineral oil, and you can measure honey, and it'll all pour out.
Yeah, that you can do the same thing. You can pour a little vegetable oil also in just a regular measuring cup, a half cup or one cup, and do the same thing. There are the measuring cups that are sort of have a piston-like device in them, and you pull it down and you measure half a cup. You put the molasses in or the honey and you push it out. And those actually, that's what we use in the kitchen here. There are a couple different manufacturers, and those work pretty well too.
Nick from Laurel, Maryland writes, in a pinch, you can cut a beer or soda can and improvise a vegetable steamer with the can and an upside-down plate. Cut the can in half carefully. Place it on the bottom of a stock pot or a large saucepan, and then place an upside-down plate on top. Fill the pan with about half inch or so of water, and you're good to go. That's what he says.
That's a pretty good idea. I mean, you know, for $5, you can buy a portable little steamer insert, but in a pinch, you could do that. The only time I'm worried about beer cans is sometimes with a lot of heat, some of the stuff they use on the outside for the labeling. Is not particularly food safe, I don't think, but in steaming, I think it would be fine.
What about when people barbecue a beer chicken, put the beer can inside the cavity of the chicken? Are you saying that the paint or the ink on the beer can might be a problem?
Yeah, we did that years ago, and I think you want to be careful about that. I mean, when it's actually touching
the meat. That's one of my favorite approaches.
Well, yeah, you've lived this long. Don't worry about it.
I was wondering what was going wrong.
Well, yeah, maybe you're smarter today. Maybe those chemicals are enhanced life. I don't know. It's something we don't know the answer. It's something we have queried, but we're not really sure. It's something to think about. But if it doesn't touch the food, I wouldn't worry about it, though.
We have a call now from Sid from Clinton Hill in Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Eleni. Congratulations on another excellent year.
Thank you.
As an afterthought to the comment before the break about ski goggles, my wife wears contact lenses, and she finds that because she wears contact lenses, she is onion-proof. So if you can have a designated contact lens wearer to chop your onions, that works. I cry like a baby, so I let her do the onion cutting. My question has to do with cast iron frying pans. We have an excellent large cast iron frying pan. And we have been, this is a tentative tip that I want some clarification on. We've been cleaning it using coarse kosher salt that we heat and scrub in to get the stuff out. And I don't know whether I am, in fact, cleaning it or just ending up with a filthy, greasy cast iron frying pan that has a lot of salt rubbed into it. So I would like an expert clarification on what the ideal way is to clean a cast iron frying pan, or if I haven't been, in fact, doing it right.
You've been doing it half right. The salt's right, but what you want to do, it depends. If it really needs cleaning, pour some vegetable oil in it with the salt and heat it up, and then using a wad of towels, be careful not to burn yourself, then scrub as you've been doing the inside of the pan. But you also want oil in it because the oil is going to get into the superheated iron and help coat it. And then just don't rinse it out. Just clean it out with paper towels. You're good to go. Every time you
oil. Well, I do an initial scraping with a metal spatula before I get to the paper towel part.
No, I think if you use oil and a lot of kosher
No,
salt,
I mean with the oil. Does. Well, okay. It works for me.
That's okay. Yeah, that's fine. But just make sure you have the oil. That's all.
Okay.
That would be the key thing. Yeah.
Jeff in Harlem suggests this tip: smash garlic, rub the garlic on the interior of the salad bowl, and it will infuse the salad.
Yes, that's a classic technique. It works. Absolutely.
Jonathan, hi. You're on the air.
Hello.
Jonathan from Brooklyn.
Hi. I like to finish or complete a cream sauce with a little bit of cream cheese melted into it instead of using cream. And I started doing this because I almost never had cream in the house, but I almost always had cream cheese. So if I'm making a dish or a sauce, I'll melt some cream cheese in and vary the liquid amount with something else like water or milk. And I just like the way it tastes. It's different than a cream sauce slightly. It's a little bit slightly cheesy, but it's also really good. So I do it all the time now.
That's one of the most interesting tips I've ever heard. I'm going to run down to the test kitchen in a few minutes, and we're going to try that. That's really interesting. Yeah.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Yeah, thanks.
You're welcome.
Now, my guest is Chris Kimball, and we're talking about tips for the kitchen. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. A listener asks, I realize that they're out of season, but when I'm picking out a watermelon, I hold it to my ear and I tap it, because that's what I've been told to do, but I have no idea what I'm actually supposed to be listening for. Help.
I'm not sure either.
Is it a hollow sound? Is it?
Yeah. Usually with a melon, you want to get sort of a hollow sound. I'm not sure that applies to watermelon, but that's what I would think. Yes.
And then we have somebody else who was wondering about the fruit that we buy in supermarkets, which all have been bred to travel well and look good. Does that mean that taste has been sacrificed?
Don't get me started. Yes. Unfortunately, there's a lot of beautiful markets around with beautiful-looking stuff, produce, too, and most of it doesn't have a lot of flavor. And it's not just the traveling, it's the breed, the thing you're starting with, it's bred for travel. And the other thing is, it's the soil. I mean, eventually everything comes down to soil and the health of the soil and the minerals it has in it and what they put on it. And so very often in high production areas, the soil, they're just putting fertilizer on it. And the Brix content, that is the sweetness of the fruit or vegetable, isn't that good. It looks great. Some of the things are fine, like apples, I think, in general, are pretty good. But a friend of mine spent a year in Paris years ago, actually Adam Reed from our TV show, and he said the thing that was astonishing to him were the cucumbers. He said it because they actually had flavor. So mm-hmm. I agree. In general, most fruit and produce in this country is lacking in flavor.
Susan, should we buy the beat-up stuff sometimes, especially if you see them at a farmer's market?
I don't think so you could, and I think organic, if you can afford it, is always a better choice than variety of grounds. It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to taste better, though. It may mean there's no pesticides on it, and it may be healthier for you. But organic is no guarantee of flavor because it depends on the soil and how it's grown and where it's grown and what they're starting with. So sometimes organic tastes better, sometimes not necessarily. It's really very individual about the farming techniques and mostly about the soil quality.
Susan in Manhattan left this tip to prevent crying while you're chopping onions. She says the prep cook in the restaurant she used to work at used to put a little piece of bread hanging out of his mouth when he chopped onions, and he would use pita or French bread, anything rigid enough to kind of stick out. The spray from the onions goes into the bread instead of into your eyes.
That would have to be a really big piece of pita to stop the fumes. I think the fumes probably are smarter than that. But, I'll try it once. So, okay.
Now, people have been asking about sharpening knives. Is it best to buy a sharpening block, or do those electric sharpeners, are they a good thing? Or a sharpening stone, an electric sharpener, or the sharpener that comes with the knife set?
And yeah, people are confused about that. If a knife really is dull, it means the edge of the knife is turned over like a U-shape, which means you have to regrind it. You can't. Sharpening steel will do nothing for a really dull knife. So if it really is dull, you have to regrind. The Chef's Choice knife sharpener we've tested for years and is our favorite. It's $130 to $60 depending on the model. They're expensive, but that's what I use. You can use a sharpening stone, but it takes 10 or 15 minutes. You need to be very patient and careful, so most people won't do that. There is a little $12 sharpener. It's made of plastic. Escapes me right now. And that actually works reasonably well. You put the knife down with a sharp edge up, and you just run this over the knife edge, and it does a fairly good job. But in general, the Chef's Choice would be my vote. And a sharpening steel just sort of tunes up a reasonably sharp knife.
A listener at KMR in New Jersey left a comment on WNYC.org saying, after decades of bread baking, I just discovered that cider that has gone from sweet to undrinkably hard makes great liquid for no-knead bread. It lends an unexpected subtle sweetness to the bread. Does that sound right to you? And I also wonder about your take on no-knead bread. How does it compare with bread that's been kneaded?
It's interesting. What people don't realize is that flour doesn't contain gluten. It has two proteins, glutenin and gliadin. And what happens is when it's hydrated, that is, it's in presence of a liquid like water, it starts to develop gluten, which is another form of the protein. So the concept of no-knead bread is that you can develop the gluten and the structure just by letting it sit long enough in contact with water, and mechanical kneading isn't really necessary. And if you let it sit long enough, that will be the essentially kneading.
So kneading just speeds up the process?
Yeah, it's a mechanical method of developing gluten. But water, actually, if you let it sit in a liquid environment long enough, if it's wet, it'll develop on its own. The other thing no-knead bread does, which is great, is you cook it, you bake it in a large cast iron Dutch oven like a Le Creuset. You have to make sure you take the top off or get a replacement metal top because the plastic ones they have shouldn't be at high temperature. And then the steam that comes out of the dough, it's a fairly high water dough. That steam gives you a really nice crust. So overall, we love it. It's a great technique. And I think what we did a version of it, it comes from a bakery in New York. Mark Bittman did the New York Times years ago. We needed
it
for
Jim Leahy's recipe.
Yes, that's right. It is. And we needed it for 2 minutes, though. And we found if you don't need it for 2 minutes, you get inconsistent results. Sometimes it rises better than other times. So 2 minutes of kneading is better than no kneading. It gives you a more consistent product.
Now, a lot of those recipes can be found just by going to the internet. You can just look up no-knead bread. But what about something more complicated, like taking the backbone out of a chicken or a turkey? Is the best thing to do is simply ask a butcher to do it?
Well, I just did it for Thanksgiving because I roast a turkey in parts. Turkey's hard. I had a 20-pound bird, and I had to take the backbone out, and that can be dangerous. You need a really good pair of poultry shears. Most don't work too well, so you want to get a really good pair. And I also find a 10-inch chef's knife is also helpful, a big knife to help with that. So that can be dangerous, and I would ask a butcher to do that unless you're comfortable using a slippery knife. A chicken, a 3.5-pound chicken, is not a problem. Just get a good pair of poultry shears, and then you just zip through on either side of the backbone, take it out, and you're done.
And so, it roasts the chicken a lot quicker, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. In turkey, you can butterfly a turkey as well, and you roast it, you flatten it. You press the breast down, so you flatten it. And then you can roast it on top of stuffing, which gives you a ton of stuffing. But instead of baking the stuffing separately, the juices from the bird will go down to the stuffing. As you said, it also means the white and dark meat gets cooked properly. Dark meat, you can't overcook dark meat. I mean, you can. I cook chicken legs sometimes for 3 or 4 hours, you know, on low temperatures. The white meat obviously does overcook, but if you flatten it out, you end up with both getting cooked to about the same, not the same doneness, but to where you want it. The dark meat will be higher than the white meat.
I don't understand why anybody doesn't prefer dark meat. It has more flavor, but that's just me. Peter.
Well, if you cook it long enough, it also gets rid of all the textural problems. So, yeah.
Peter from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I have a little bit of a tip and a question that I inherited from my father. When I'm making pancakes on my griddle, instead of using any oil, there's some oil in the batter, but I don't oil the surface of the griddle at all. I take a piece of cotton cloth, maybe like broadcloth or something like that, and then I'll put a bunch of salt, just table salt, maybe a quarter cup or something like that, and I make a little satchel, a little bundle out of it. I tie it up. And then once the griddle is heated, I rub the surface of it with this salt bag. And I don't know why, but it makes it nonstick.
Have you heard that before, Chris?
No, this is a good show. I got a couple great tips here. No, I have no idea why that would work. But you know what? We'll test it next week. That's really interesting. I just use a vegetable oil spray, give it 2 really quick, tiny sprays, and then wipe it down with a paper towel. But we'll try it. Sounds interesting.
Do you brine your turkey?
Yes, I do. I use 1/2 cup of table salt per gallon of water, about 6 hours. And I did a braised turkey this year. So the one thing about braising is you cook it in parts, and you can cook the dark meat as long as you like extra, which is nice. But I definitely brine it. The thing people sometimes mistake is a lot of frozen turkeys, like butterballs, for example, are really pre-brined. They're injected with a saline solution. So you have to make absolutely sure that the turkey you're dealing with has not been brined or injected with a solution to start with.
Just one more. In the February issue of Cook's Magazine, one of your readers suggested using a teaspoon to help peel a hard-boiled egg. Peeling a hard-boiled egg is always a problem for me because little bits of the shell always seem to stick. How does that work?
Well, it's sort of like doing a kiwi. You know, you cut off the ends of the kiwi and use a teaspoon to get in between the meat and the skin. The problem with that technique is sometimes, and we've tried this for years, sometimes hard-boiled eggs, it doesn't matter how old the eggs are, we've tested all that. Sometimes, as you know, the shell sticks like crazy. The one thing we do find is helpful is immediately immersing the boiled egg into very cold water for about 30 seconds. And that seems to help a little bit. And that spoon trick does help a little bit, too. If you get right underneath that film, you know, that skin underneath the eggshell itself. Mm-hmm. But if you have an egg that it's really stuck on, it's going to be a problem. There's no easy way around that.
Chris, it's always so much fun talking with you. Thank you so much for being on our show
again. Yeah, all the best for the holidays. Take care.
And Chris Kimball, as you probably know, is the editor and founder of Cook's Illustrated. He revived that revered magazine. Also, Cook's Country Magazine. He's the host of PBS's America's Test Kitchens and sometimes visitor to our show. It's always a pleasure.